It is Friday, the 9th of October, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. Coming up...
The Nobel Peace Prize for 2015 is to be awarded to the Tunisian National Dialogue Quartet.
We will tell you more about the quartet. Just what is Russia doing in Syria and why? We'll take a closer look at that question. And a new study shows that firstborn children suffer from worse eyesight than their siblings. That is all ahead. Our top story on International Edition this Friday is the Nobel Peace Prize awarded to the Tunisian National Dialogue Quartet for what it called its decisive contribution to the building of a pluralistic democracy in Tunisia in the wake of the Jasmine Revolution of 2011. The Nobel Committee cited the quartet for stabilizing the country at a time when it had reached the brink of civil war. The groups making up the Tunisian National Dialogue Quartet are the Tunisian General Labor Union, the Tunisian Confederation of Industry, Trade and Handicrafts, the Tunisian Human Rights League, and the Tunisian Order of Lawyers. We welcome to International Edition Dr. Sarah Foyer. She is an expert on politics and religion in North Africa. Dr. Foyer is a Sora Fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, and she joins us now from Morocco. Dr. Foyer, many of us have never heard of the Tunisia National Dialogue Quartet. Can you tell us more about it?
Sure, and thank you for having me on the program. So the National Dialogue, as you noted in the introduction, was a group of four civil society organizations in Tunisia that came together in the summer of 2013 to try and get the country's political process back on track. And it's important to remember that this came against the backdrop of mass protests and calls for the National Constituent Assembly, the parliament at the time, to dissolve following a series of high-profile political assassinations, some jihadist attacks on military installations in the western part of the country along the Algerian border, clashes in the interior of the country between police and activists and other militants. And so there was a general sense that the country was on the verge of collapse. And these four organizations came together and essentially provided a forum for the political parties to come to the negotiating table and hash out an agreement to try and bring the country through this impasse. And they succeeded. It was not easy, but I think that the prize that was announced today really is a testament to the work that these civil society groups did in 2013 and frankly have continued to do throughout this transition in Tunisia.
That leads to my next question. Is it still an entity, this quartet? Are they still working for work that still has to be done in Tunisia?
So that's a very good question. It's a little bit unclear. After the achievements of the National Dialogue in the fall of 2013 and especially in the winter, essentially what happened was the government at the time, which was dominated by an Islamist party, agreed to step down and give power to a caretaker government, which then took over in early 2014. And set up the schedule for elections for a new parliament and a president later on that year. The other main achievement of the quartet of the National Dialogue was to facilitate the final promulgation of the new constitution, which has been widely praised as really one of the most progressive constitutions in the Arab world. But then this question arose of what now to do with this national dialogue and whether there would need to be a continued role for this coalition of organizations to ensure that Tunisia didn't face yet another didn't come to another impasse. I have to be honest, it's been a little bit unclear to me the extent to which the National Dialogue as a formal entity has continued to function. I think every now and then there is talk of needing to reconstitute it and have it intervene. I mean, you hear this a lot when it starts to look like the political parties are reaching an impasse. But so far as I can tell, it hasn't really reconstituted itself in the same way as it did in 2013. I think that, I mean, I hope anyway, that the issuing of this Nobel Prize will not only give a psychological boost to the country, especially that, you know, as it continues to sort of reeling from these terrorist attacks and trying to find a way out of economic distress, but also that it will motivate Tunisia's political class to keep the process going and to not forget what really brought people to the streets in 2010 and 2011.
Dr. Sarah Foyer, an expert on politics and religion in North Africa. Dr. Foyer is a Sora Fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. Dr. Foyer, thanks so much for joining us today from Morocco. Joining us is Charlie Hansler. He has been keeping his eyes on social media most of this day. Charlie, what's hot?
The most popular hashtag on Twitter related to the announcement of the Tunisian National Dialogue Quartet winning the Nobel Peace Prize is understandably hashtag Nobel Peace Prize. According to the social media analytics website Topsy.com, over 3,000 tweets with that hashtag have been tweeted in the past 2 hours. The awarding of the Nobel Peace Prize is popular on Twitter. Many different news outlets have tweeted about the awarding of the prize to the Tunisian National Dialogue Quartet, such as MTV's news division, at MTV News, who tweeted out, quote, "Congrats to the 2015 hashtag Nobel Peace Prize winner, the Tunisian National Dialogue Quartet," end quote. This has a link to the article, to an article on the subject.
Well, we have a lot of other major news happening in addition to the Nobel Peace Prize. There has been another shooting, still finding out more about that in the U.S. state of Arizona at another school there. We'll be talking to Mohammed Al-Shanawi just a bit about what is happening as far as Russia and Syria is concerned. What else is coming up?
Well, the other popular hashtags today are hashtag Northern Arizona University because of that tragic shooting that happened this morning at Northern Arizona University in Flagstaff, and hashtag Happy Birthday John Lennon is popular today because it would have been his 75th birthday today.
I know that doesn't make you feel old, but it certainly does me. Thanks, Charlie.
Thanks, Ira.
This is International Edition. A meeting of NATO defense ministers in Brussels has focused on Russia's intervention in the Syrian civil war. The head of NATO, Jens Stoltenberg, slammed Russia's what he called troubling escalation of military activities in Syria after Moscow's intensified air campaign against the Syrian rebels. Stoltenberg said after the defense ministers' meeting that he urged Russia to play a productive role in Syria, and he said a political solution is more needed than ever in the Syrian conflict. Mohammed Al-Shanawi, International Edition senior Middle East reporter, has been following a panel discussion about the U.S. and the Middle East where William Burns, former Deputy Secretary of State and a former U.S. ambassador to Russia, warned against doing nothing to counter the Russian military intervention in Syria. Mohammed, what kind of actions are still available for the United States in Syria?
Well, while the U.S., Russia, Iran, and the Arab states are all saying that a political transition is the only solution to that Syrian crisis, Ambassador Burns explained how detrimental is protecting the Syrian opposition to any influence on any future transition to end the Syrian crisis.
So the question is, how do you influence the very unsentimental views of the Russians and the Iranians, who are right now determined to, you know, bolster the Assad regime? And that's why I think things like a safe zone in southern Syria along the Jordanian border that might be practical as a response to humanitarian imperatives to enable diplomacy. Because if you don't build a little bit more leverage right now, it's hard for me to see how you make much progress, no matter what the shape of the table is in diplomacy. Yes, you got to engage the Russians and the Iranians, but it's what you engage them with, I think, that makes a difference.
Syrian opposition emphasized the need to create a safe zone in southern Syria, where the largest coalition of Syrian fighters, including the Free Syrian Army, is located.
But what would the Russian military intervention in Syria alter the situation on the ground?
Well, some experts believe it would if the Syrian regime was able to use Russian air cover to launch ground attacks to retake areas that are currently under the control of the Syrian opposition fighters. However, Ambassador Burns argues that Russian President Putin has different objectives in Syria.
He wants to bolster the Assad regime, which, you know, over recent months had been losing altitude, I think. He wants to reassert Russia's role. So if there ever is any serious diplomatic process that, you know, Russia's established its position at center stage, he doesn't mind sticking a thumb in the eye of the United States. And he doesn't mind trying to change the channel, you know, from Ukraine.
Ambassador Burns concludes that while the Russian military involvement can make a bad situation in Syria worse, it can also further erode people's sense of U.S. leadership in the Middle East.
You and I were talking earlier about something that puzzled us somewhat, and it was dealt with the words of U.S. Defense Secretary Ash Carter criticizing what he deemed increasingly unprofessional behavior from Russian forces. Those are the words he used at the NATO summit in Brussels. What does that mean for critics of the Obama's administration's response to the Russian military intervention in Syria?
Well, IRA Senator John McCain, chairman of the U.S. Senate's Armed Services Committee, was quick to criticize this statement, saying that Russians are winning.
They have now, for the first time since 1973, played a major role in the Middle East, and they're achieving all of their objectives while we sit by and call it a quagmire, or, in the words of the Secretary of Defense, unprofessional. It has become almost a joke.
Mohammed, thanks once again for bringing us this latest news and perspective.
Thank you, Ira, for having me.
This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
Are you nearsighted and also the firstborn in your family? British scientists have found a link between nearsightedness and birth order. The researchers took information from a UK database of people between 40 and 69 years of age who have had their vision analyzed. After making adjustments for age, gender, and education, they found that the first-born people were about 10% more likely to be myopic than their later-born siblings. Among the risk factors for myopia are genetic background, the amount of time spent outdoors, and how it is spent doing reading, writing, working with a computer, and the like. The researchers suggest that parents tend to be more attentive to the education needs of the firstborn than those born later. This could mean that the firstborn child does more reading and other so-called near work compared to their siblings, which would increase the odds of them having myopia. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition. I'm Ira Melman. A study leads to some questions about the value of digital technology in the classroom, not just here in the United States, but worldwide. The findings of the report from the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, or the OECD, says simply putting computers and other digital devices in schools will not necessarily help children get better grades. From Paris, joining us is Andreas Schleicher. Mr. Schleicher runs the Directorate of Education and Skills and is Special Advisor on Education Policy to the Secretary General of the OECD. Andreas, thanks for being with us. Was what I just read a fair assessment of the findings?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, if you look at the most successful education systems, including those who have the most technology-savvy students, they have actually been quite cautious in integrating technology in classrooms. And where they do, they typically start with teachers, you know, connecting teachers, building platforms for teacher collaboration, and then gradually they roll it out to students. Whereas in many countries where sort of technology has been rushed into classrooms, we actually see it's detracted rather than added to learning outcomes. It was a big surprise for us, too.
Why is this happening?
Well, you know, if you add 21st century technology to 20th century teaching, then we may not add, but actually just detract from learning. Now, if students end up copying and pasting stuff from Google to prefabricated questions, and if we're not designing the kind of learning environments that actually make good use out of technology, that use technology to amplify great teaching, then we may not do students a service. That's what these data show, and they're quite consistent across many countries.
The report is suggesting that students who make below average use of computers at school actually have the highest performance when it comes to digital reading. How can that be?
Yeah, that's an interesting finding, actually. What this tells you is that building strong foundations, you know, giving students the kind of conceptual skills to distinguish relevant from irrelevant information, to access, manage, integrate knowledge. I mean, those kind of fundamentals need to be built first. And where we don't spend enough time on this, but, you know, just rush through technology, learning can become superficial and students may end up worse than without technology. At least that's what this data suggests. And once again, if you look, for example, to Japan, if you look to Singapore, if you look to Korea or to Shanghai, the East Asian countries that are doing really well on digital skills, they actually are very, very conscious in how they integrate technology into learning experiences. And it's not a dominant factor there, you know. Technology can amplify great teaching, but technology is not going to replace poor teaching.
Tell us something about the scope of this survey and the timing of it, if you will.
Yeah, you know, the survey was 60,000 students around the world were assessed, so it's the most comprehensive data that we now have on the digital skills of young people, and then we looked at the technology they had in the schools, all based on representative samples in 32 countries, so it is the most comprehensive evidence base that we have. The timing, it was done in 2012, so things have moved on since then, but we don't know whether for the better, no.
So what are the recommendations? Are there recommendations here?
Yeah, I think, you know, we got to be cautious about this. We have to make sure that we have a clear strategy, that we prepare the teachers well, that we overcome the resistance to change that, you know, some teachers, some schools may still have, that we prepare the ground, that we advance the pedagogic strategies, the instructional material. Now, you can't just add on technology to traditional teaching. What these new technologies call for are entirely new learning environment, but the opportunities are very important. You know, we can't, why would you want students to learn from a textbook that was printed last year and maybe designed 5 years ago if they can access the world's most advanced knowledge through the internet? We can design environments for experiential learning. Your students can their own simulations. They can go into virtual labs. I mean, there are fantastic opportunities. But what is quite clear now is that there are more bad examples than good ones around the world today.
Andrea Schleicher of OECD, thanks so much for being with us here from Paris.
Thank you very much.
This is International Edition. A legendary country music venue in Nashville, Tennessee, just celebrated its 90th birthday. VOA's Country Hits USA host Nikki Strong joins International Edition's Sarah Williams to talk about this milestone.
Well, if you've heard of legends such as Loretta Lynn, Johnny Cash, Willie Nelson, many of these country music icons' work has been promoted to the world via a radio show called the Grand Ole Opry. Well, now this small radio show grew into a major concert venue and cultural institution. And this past week, it celebrated its 90th birthday with all of the big stars in country music. VOA's Nikki Strong is here to talk with us about it. Nikki, how did it get so huge?
Oh, my goodness. Well, it was a small radio show back in 1925, and it was founded by George Hay. And it was a live radio show that featured performances from different country artists. It still airs on WSM AM, which had a huge signal, and it enabled the show to reach an exponentially large audience beyond Nashville, Tennessee. And in the process, it became a huge player in exposing and introducing the world to country music. And the Grand Ole Opry, as a consequence, is credited with helping to shape and define the actual genre. And in the process, it's become a source of inspiration for anyone who wants to perform in country music. Reba McEntire, who said she went to a Grand Ole Opry performance before she was a teenager. Oh. And she saw it and said, I want to do that. And look where she is now. So It's been incredible. And Grand Ole Opry has become the pinnacle of a lot of country artist careers. To be inducted and asked to be a member of the Grand Ole Opry is like being inducted into the Hall of Fame. It's selective, it's elitist, and it's a huge, huge honor.
And now it's moved around a lot, too. It's had 6 homes in 90 years.
Yeah. I think by the time I'm 90, I probably will have moved about 6 times at least as well. It has had 6 homes. At first, it was at the National Life and Accident Insurance Company back in 1925. And then it moved several times between 1934 and 1943. It landed at the Ryman Auditorium before it actually settled into its current Grand Ole Opry House in March 1974. I think one of the cool things about it is that when it moved from the Ryman to its current location, a 6-foot circle of oak was cut from the stage at Ryman and inserted into the new stage at the Grand Ole Opry. So by preserving a piece of the Ryman stage, generations of country music singers can perform on the wood where their legendary predecessors
and performed.
Stood.
Yeah.
Yes,
yeah.
Exactly.
A lot of memories there.
Yeah.
Well, is it just country music artists that have performed at the Grand Ole Opry?
No, actually, I mean, it's primarily a country music venue. That is its claim to fame, and that's where it's committed. But actors and actresses and other singers as well have graced the stage. President Richard Nixon actually was at the Grand Ole Opry, as well as actor Kevin Bacon, James Brown, Stevie Wonder, Kevin Costner, Robert Duvall, just to name a few.
Yeah, quite a variety of performers
or
visitors there. Yeah.
Yes.
Well, you can reach Nikki Strong on Twitter at @VOA_music and on Facebook at VOA Music. You can also hear her on VOA's Country Hits USA. Thanks a lot, Nikki.
Thank you.
Elvira. Elvira. My heart's on fire for Elvira.
Now, that is our program for today. Thanks for being with us. Why don't you visit our website at voanews.com for further explanations, more stories, everything you'd like to know. My name's Ira Melman. Thanks so much for being with us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The U.S. Department of Energy's National Security Administration announced on September 30th the successful return of the final 5 kilograms of highly enriched uranium spent fuel from the IIN-3M Photon Research Reactor in Tashkent, Uzbekistan, to Russia. This is the 8th shipment of highly enriched uranium from Uzbekistan since 2004 and marks the removal of all highly enriched uranium from the country. Since the Russian research reactor fuel return program began in 2002, the Department of Energy has collaborated with partner countries to successfully repatriate more than 2,200 kilograms of Russian-origin highly enriched uranium from around the world, enough for nearly 100 nuclear weapons. This includes the removal of all Russian-origin highly enriched uranium from 11 countries. Furthermore, this shipment marks the 28th country overall, plus Taiwan, to have partnered with the Department of Energy to become free of all highly enriched uranium. The highly enriched uranium removal was logistically challenging, as it was the first transport of liquid, highly enriched uranium spent fuel by air. The journey began at Uzbekistan's Photon facility, where the material was packaged for road transport to the airport. It was then loaded into another specialized container for transport by air to a secure facility in Russia. This complex operation was the culmination of a multi-year effort between the Department of Energy, Uzbekistan, Russia, and the International Atomic Energy Agency. Following this highly enriched uranium removal, the IAEA will lead efforts to assist Uzbekistan in the decommissioning of the Photon facility, with support from the Department of Energy and the United Kingdom's Department of Energy and Climate Change. This final highly enriched uranium removal from Uzbekistan under our collaboration with Russia to repatriate Russian-origin fuel marks another step toward the goal of minimizing or eliminating highly enriched uranium from civil applications, said Department of Energy National Security Administration Deputy Administrator Ann Harrington. This shipment and our ongoing work with Russia and the International Atomic Energy Agency, she noted, advance global efforts to secure, consolidate, and minimize the use of highly enriched uranium so it does not fall into the hands of terrorists.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.